Elohim is not a name. Elohim is a description of a type of being or a category of being.
He doesn't say that they exchanged the truth of God for something that doesn't exist and they started making up make-believe things. He says that they exchanged the truth of God for lie and started worshiping the creation rather than the creator who is forever praised.
Welcome to another episode of Kingdoms Unveiled. And we are excited today to go in and help you look at your Bible and maybe pull back some of the clutter that has been covering up what we would say the helpful and powerful parts of the story of God's Word. At times, we won't pick up the gospel and wear it rightly because we don't think there's a real threat. And so when Paul says, put on the full armor of God, which is Christ, he really means it. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to pull back the veil so you can see the real war that's happening in the kingdom of darkness and how we who have the light are running into this kingdom, rescuing people who are in slavery. Your hosts are Doug Van Dorn, who's the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church in Northern Colorado. You can find that church. It actually has a location. It's not just in the greater part of the state. It's in Boulder. And I'm John Moffitt. I'm the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. Doug, big announcement. This would be the first official announcement where we talk about this, something you and I have been working on for a long time, many late nights and early mornings, and still working on it. But Doug, tell them what they have available for them right now. What's this new venture we got going?
Well, what's the website, John? Why don't you tell them that first?
Yeah. So we had came up with a lot of them, and we felt like the best way to describe what we're doing here at Kingdoms is we love Reformed theology, and we're trying to talk about the supernatural. So we put them together, and the website is reformedfringe.com. And what is reformedfringe.com?
So let me give you the purpose statement.
Yeah.
And the mission statement and the vision statement. As a marketing
this is a big
major
kind of like the opening
30 years ago.
Yeah, this is episode one, so we'll give you the full commercial.
The purpose of the Reformed Fringe is to meet an untapped need that helps Christians think about, interact with, and network with one another over a variety of biblical and secular fringe topics from the foundation of Reformed theology. And that's where it's unique, right? That we're actually Reformed Christians. There are other places you can go that are kind of all over the map in terms of where people are coming from theologically, but we're Reformed and we want to help people think about these things just like this podcast from the foundation of Reformed theology. So that's our kind of purpose statement. The mission is to provide a valuable shared networking experience mm-hmm. for Reformed Christians, people interested in Reformed theology, or people who will not be hostile to Reformed theology. You're welcome. And we'd love to have you join us, actually. These people who want and need a secure and sheltered and shielded place to discuss, learn, and share and grow in their knowledge of the fringy areas of biblical theology in the world around us. And our vision is really to make this a centralized hub of all things Reformed and fringy. So that we'll be adding articles. We already have a bunch up there, books.
Yep.
Offering my books to people in PDF, blogs and podcasts and recommended resources and live events and special guests and courses over time and interactive chats and groups, all of them focusing on the mission of this. So, and we're excited. Yeah. It's up and running. We launched it back last Friday, which would have been, January 18th or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So it'll be a couple of weeks after that, after you hear this. So, yeah, we wanted to make it listen, guys, to get into this thing costs you like two coffees a month to get into this thing. And the reason we did that is it really does keep it safe. And the fringe space and the reform space can get like really highly debated. And
this isn't a safe space thing, you know, like in the woke yeah. world. This is like we no. want to keep it so that the riffraff and trolls and stuff like that don't come in yep. and just create havoc.
Yeah, in that way, it is safe, meaning like you're not going to get it's not going to be just dumb debates that no one wants to be a part of. We are rescued from that, so to say. It's what I love about it, Doug, is that we kind of created a space where we wish this existed when we first had all yeah. these questions, like really simple articles to read. I mean, there's like 14 of Doug's books that are on there, and they go the range from conspiracy theory to giants to angel of the Lord to five solas. I mean, it's all in there. So there's some good stuff in there. I wrote his revelation stuff's in there. I posted recently. I got a couple articles, and you've got, I don't know, what, 7, 8, 9 articles in there already, and adding more. So anyways, go check it out. You can also go to douglasvandorn.com to see his resources and a link there. And my website is johnmoffitt.com. You can just go to either one of those. You'll find it. But the Reformed Fringe, we're excited. It's been already a fun time in there, and all kinds of stuff from Reformed to fringy. It's pretty,
that's the point.
It's pretty wild. It's pretty wild. All right. So this particular episode, we're hoping would be shared. Shared amongst the Reform crowd, or I would just say Christianity in general. If you're not Reform, this is, I would not say what we're going to talk about today is Reform theology, but we're talking about it from a Reform perspective. I think anybody can believe this. It doesn't have to hold to one particular tradition. Something like Calvinism would be Reformed in its core. The reason why Doug and I want to talk about this is that there are parts of our Bible that get ignored. And you lose the thrust of the entire understanding and what's happening and what's going on. And when you do this, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, imagine Star Wars. Are you ready for this, Doug? I'm going to throw this at you right now. Imagine Star Wars without the Force. It would be really hard to, like, what is this about? And like, they never explained this Force, and there was no use of the Force. It was just kind of ignored. It would change really the idea, because what's the whole thing? It's about light and dark. It's about the good versus the bad. And there's this supernatural power that's behind it. And it's at the core. I mean, when you think of Star Wars, let the Force be with you. I mean, it's at the center of the story. I mean, is that fair? I don't want to do the whole chiasm thing. I know we already talked about that. The rings of Star Wars. When we're thinking about the story of the Bible, we at times remove the spiritual side of it, the supernatural side of it. We can acknowledge certain characters, but we toss other characters out. So we wanted to do a basic introduction to certain characters and how they work and how this spiritual war functions. And at times it's better to just start with some of the basics of, like, who are the gods? And how do we wrap our mind around the Bible and how they use it? And I think there's going to be people at different levels and different perspectives. And so we're going to start from the basic and work all the way up. So this is going to be a super long episode, but we wanted to really just give a place to where we can have a legitimate introduction on this level. So if you've never thought about this before, or if you're wrestling with it, this episode is for you. Doug, we'll start here. Typically, when people hear the first commandment in the Bible, you shall have no other gods before me, they immediately think about idols. Oh, this is something you turn into a god, whether it be money, a human being, a pharaoh. It's something we turn into a god. Has that been your experience when you're talking with people? This is not necessarily an equivalent to God, but something that you put in its place.
Yeah, the gods are idols, and idols are the gods that you have in your life. So, you know, you worship sports, you worship clothes. Those are your gods. That's what gods are.
That's right. What I think the problem is when we're dealing with this word is that we don't understand really its etymology. We don't understand at its core where it comes from and what it describes. The word for God in the Old Testament is Elohim, and in the New Testament is Theos. And the word Elohim is, we often think it is like it's a name. We think Elohim is a name. We attribute it, like, there's Lord, there's God, there's, you know, Yahweh, there's Father, but actually each one of those has a different meaning and different structure to it. So Elohim is not a name. Elohim is a description of a type of being or a category of being. For instance, in the physical realm, we have what are called humans. That describes a living creature, and it describes a set of living creatures. So it separates us from animals. We are humans. And within humanity, there's male and female. It actually breaks down even farther. But we who are alive and have cognitive capacities, have been made in the image of God, our category of being are humans, right? In the Old Testament, the spiritual realm, the realm to which that we are unfamiliar with, they actually have a category of being. So all that live in the spiritual realm, well, we're going to argue it here for in a minute, have the title Elohim, which is really hard for us at times to think about that. So if you are a spiritual being and you live in God's realm of the spirit realm, your category would be Elohim. That would mean that there's a lot of different kinds. So like in our realm, there's male and female. In this realm, there's all different kinds. It's not necessarily separated by gender. It's separated by kinds of spiritual beings. Now, I'm going to go out of this gate right here now, Doug, just because I don't want to lose people. We will eventually get here. We wholeheartedly believe in the creeds of confession that God, the Father, Yahweh, is unique and one of a kind. There is no other one like him. He is all-knowing, all-powerful. He is self-sustaining, uncreated, the creator of all things, eternally inexistent. There is none like him. He is unique. And yet, because he lives in the spiritual realm, it makes him what? An Elohim. Would you, I want to make sure I didn't say anything heretical there.
No, I think that that's right. I mean, it's certainly biblically correct that God is Elohim, and there are other Elohim that are out there. And this is just anytime you read something like Psalm 136:2, give thanks to the God of gods. Yeah. Okay, so here you have the word Elohim appearing twice. It's actually Le Elohe Ha Elohim, but both of those are the word Elohim. It's just a different ending for the way that the Hebrew grammar works, but he's the Elohim of all the Elohim. Mm-hmm. Whenever you find the psalmist commanding the gods to praise God, those are the Elohim. And there's many of those kinds of verses that are out there. Mm-hmm. So these Elohim exist, and at least in the biblical text, we would argue that they exist in real life. They're actual creatures that are there. God is compared to other Elohim. Maybe it would be helpful for Reform folks to think about God in terms of what we call incommunicable attributes and communicable attributes. Mm-hmm. Big words, but they're really not that hard of concepts.
Right.
An incommunicable attribute is an attribute that is not able to be communicated to anything else. A communicable one is something that is able to be communicated. So an incommunicable attribute would be omniscience. God alone knows all things. However, knowledge, which is a subcategory of omniscience, is communicable. So human beings have knowledge. We know things. Mm-hmm. So God knows things and we know things. We don't know them as God knows them, but we still know them. And so he's communicated that attribute to us. And if we want to think of Elohim almost as an attribute, I think that that's helpful. God is Elohim in a way that nothing else is Elohim, because he has all these incommunicable attributes. He's eternal. No other creature is eternal, but we all have lives. We exist. He's communicated life, but not self-life, life that comes only generated from himself in eternity. No other being has that. So all those incommunicable attributes are what God gives to any of his creatures that have those attributes, right? So if Elohim is actually an attribute, then it goes to make sense that there could possibly, theoretically, be other Elohim that exist in this universe, because it's an attribute. The question is it communicable or incommunicable? And our answer is that it's a communicable attribute. Elohim is. But the incommunicable is all these other things that belong to God and God alone that we That's confess right. that we believe in.
Mm-hmm. I think Psalm 95 is really helpful here. So I'm going to read it And then I'm going to use the Hebrew with it as well. So for the Lord, Yahweh, all caps. So it's making a distinction for this unique, our God, for the Lord, Yahweh, is a great God. The word there is Elohim. So again, it's describing what he is. Yahweh is an Elohim, and he is a great Elohim. And then he goes on to say, and a great king above all Elohim, right? So the writer is describing that God, that the Lord, Yahweh, is a great being that's in the spiritual realm. And not only he's great, he is the king. He is the supreme. Another term that's used is the most high. You can't have a most high if you only have one, right? You have to have more than one to have a most high. So this means that the king, the most high, is an Elohim amongst other Elohim. But it is very, very important, and it's part of our monotheistic theology, that we believe that there is only one who holds the incommunicable attributes, the one who holds the uncreated title, the creator of all things. But you will see this is a very common way for the Old Testament to speak about their God, the Israelites' God. Exodus 3:18, it talks about how they were brought out of the wilderness and they made sacrifices to the Lord, our God. Why would they say this? Because there's a contrast. We're not making sacrifices to the gods of Egypt. We just left those gods. We're making a sacrifice to Yahweh, our God. There's a distinction between the two. Now, there's another part about this word that's important to understand as you're interpreting it. Going back to something like Psalm 95:3, where you have the word Elohim and Elohim used twice. It's the same word, but it's used twice. And the word Elohim very much works like sheep or deer. You don't know if it's singular or plural unless you look at it in its context. And this is why, the reason why this is important is that if you're reading it in the Hebrew at times, you're going to see that it's plural, plural. It's like, well, what is it? Is it plural or is it singular? And here we can see that the first time it's talking about for the Lord Yahweh, this is talking about our God, Yahweh, is a great Elohim. It's talking about the one God. And then the second time it says, for he's a great God above all Elohim, which means, as you learn, there's more than just one. So it's healthy to understand just how the word is being, first of all, what is the word itself? It is not a name. It's a category of being. Number two, it works like it's deer or sheep. It can be plural in nature, or it can be singular. You have to look at it from its context. Now, if that's the case, what we would have to argue then, Doug, is that Elohim are not conjured up beings of the imagination of the pagans, right? The reason why I have to make that distinction is that the writers aren't saying this in contrast of look at our God compared to your God. The psalm actually isn't, the psalmist in Psalm 95, I would say the Psalm 95 is not saying this in a negative stance of a comparison, as if there's nowhere in the Psalms it gives us an indication that those gods are evil or bad. Is that fair?
Say that again.
So sometimes when we hear lowercase god, we immediately think negative bad, Elohim.
Correct.
Correct.
Yeah.
But
think of it as an idol that is something that we've created in the place of God.
Right. So for instance, like in Psalm 95 or in other Psalms where it talks about the gods praising or before the gods, in the midst of gods, or even the gods are to give praise to Yahweh, it's not necessarily pointing to the pagan idols in those particular contexts, because I'll just go ahead and say this now. Angels that are in allegiance to the king would fit into the category of being Elohim. You tracking with me now?
Well, yeah. And in fact, the word angel is actually sometimes used to translate Elohim. So in the Septuagint, that's what the Greek Jewish translators often use. So worship him, all you gods, becomes worship him, all you angels, in some of these later psalms in the Septuagint.
I'll give you an example. So Psalm, if you want to turn, you can look at this. Psalm 8:5 is directly quoted by Hebrews 2:7.
Yeah.
So it says, for you have made him a little lower than the angels. Now, the word there in Hebrew is Elohim, right? So Psalm 8:5, if you're going to go online, you can hover it over it and it'll give you the, you know, what is the Hebrew word? It's going to tell you that it's Elohim. When you look at the Hebrew translation of this passage, it says, for you have made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor. So this is Hebrews 2:7. So sometimes what's really healthy and helpful to do is look at what did the inspired New Testament writers think about these passages? How did they interpret that? And so they're using this as a safe way of understanding this, or a way for us to interpret this, is that Elohim can also mean angels. I mean, it can mean other things, but for in this particular situation, it's okay to say that the writer of Hebrews did not have a problem saying that a category of being that functions in the Elohim realm, in the realm of the spirit underneath Elohim, is angels. This isn't just a one-off, though. Thankfully, we have a couple of times it does this. Deuteronomy 32, it says, rejoice with him, O heavens, bow down to him, all gods. And then you have Psalm 97:7, same thing about worshiping all the gods. And Hebrews 1:6 directly quotes both Psalm and Deuteronomy 22, and it says, let all the angels worship him. So this is talking about the coming of the firstborn of the Messiah, and it says, let all the angels worship him. The reason why I'm mentioning this is that we can safely say Elohim is the category of being, Yahweh is in this category, and angels are also in this category. Any thoughts on that before we move on to the next one?
Yeah, other than just to say again, to reiterate, that God is in the category of being of Elohim, but none of the other Elohim are in the category of God. In as
of Yahweh.
Said. Yeah, so
that's right.
He's unique. I mean, it's kind of Boolean algebra. It's all X or Y, but not all Y or X, you know, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just really important to say that. And for whatever reason, John, for the life of me, I don't understand why this is a hard concept to grasp.
I think it's been beat into us, man. It's been beat into our brains that polytheism is evil.
Like, I get that people read the first commandment the way that they read it. This is an ironic thing in some ways, because we're Protestants and we pride ourselves on the fact that we don't break up, especially as Reformed Christians, we don't break the Ten Commandments up the way the evil Roman Catholics do.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they combine the first and second commandment into one. Mm-hmm. And then they divide coveting into two. Well, we have the first commandment as you shall have no other gods before me. And the second commandment is you shall not make for yourself a likeness of anything earth above or below the earth or on the earth that is an idol.
Mm-hmm.
But when we functionally read the first commandment, we put it as if it is the second commandment and turn it into an idol. Now, maybe it's not an idol that you make with hands. Okay. So, you know, sports is my idol. Okay. Well, it's not something that I have as a statue in my house, although probably a lot of people do. you know, a little statue of John Elway, or, you know, dating myself, something like that. You know, you got your football helmets in your room, whatever, like this is what you have, a painting on your wall, whatever. See, that's your idol. That's what we say. But when it's second we do that, we have collapsed the first and second commandments into the same thing. We become functional Roman Catholics at that point.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that as you read the text, you will see why, like, I think we just have an anemic view of idolatry. I think that's what's happening here. We don't really understand how idols work and idol worship, which we can get into. But to say, it's like God gets a category of his own, and then all other gods like somehow have fit into the category of idols or man-made.
Imaginations.
They're
fake things. So, mm-hmm. you know, when you have the Psalm 138:1 is another good example of the God-angel thing. Mm-hmm. I give you thanks, O Lord, with my whole heart before the Elohim, before the gods, I sing your praise. That's the ESV. That becomes before the angels, I sing your praise.
Yep.
In the Septuagint. But the thing is, stop and think about this for a second.
Yep.
Here's the psalmist praising God, a real being, with his whole heart. And I'm supposed to think that what he says next is that before the imaginary creatures, before the Super Friends, before the Justice League, before the X-Men, yeah, I sing your praise. Before Mickey Mouse, I sing your praise. Absurdity of that, and not only the absurdity of that, but the way that that demeans who God actually is, to say that before things that don't exist, I sing your praise. People don't stop and think about the logic of that, John. That's why it's just critical to get it out of our heads that the gods aren't real. There's a point to be made here about something that takes place, because I know where people go with this. They go to the prophets like Isaiah, who effectively say things like the gods aren't real, but they're not understanding. There's no God besides me. Besides, I think we talked about this in an earlier episode, but I don't remember where there's all the difference in the world between beside and besides. Besides means there is no one else at all. Beside means that there's nobody who's alongside of me. In other words, they're all behind me. But it's not that they don't exist. And what people do is they don't realize that the prophets are mocking. It's satire, and it's it's that genre of stuff. Like when Elijah goes to Mount Carmel, right? And he says, how come Baal can't start your fire? Is he in the bathroom? Is he relieving himself? mocking them, because what they're doing is they're worshiping created beings as if they are the uncreated eternal creator. The effect of that is that because God is infinitely incomparable, it is as if you're worshiping something that doesn't even exist. But they're not saying they don't exist. All you have to do is read everywhere else in their books to find out that these creatures are real. And you have to learn to understand what sarcasm and satire are, and why the prophets spoke the way that they did about these evil creatures, because it absolutely infuriated them that Israel, who had been called by the only true living God himself, who has life in himself, called them out of nothing and did all these incredible things to them, that they would go then immediately turning their back on him and start worshiping created things, which is what Paul, you know, in Romans 1 starts talking about what they did. He doesn't say they went in, you know, Romans 1, what is it, 20 and 21, 22. Yeah. He doesn't say that they exchanged the truth of God for something that doesn't exist and they started making up make-believe things. He says that they exchanged the truth of God for lie and started worshiping the creation rather than the creator who is forever praised.
That's right. I think sometimes it's helpful, like, to piggyback on what you're saying, is that when we say before the angel, like if when we read the verse, before the angels, I sing your praise. Everybody, we get that. I mean, we think about Revelation and the myriads of.
Yeah, exactly. Revelation 4:5 or Isaiah 6, where Isaiah comes and there's the holy ones that are there before the throne of God, and they got the six wings and they're covering their face. We get that there are creatures that are actually up there in heaven with God around that, however that temple works, they're real.
That's right. And I think it's healthy. The argument we're making here is that they get the title Elohim, that this is from the text. Okay. This isn't some like weird idea. This is right here from the text. They are called Elohim. And when the Septuagint, the New Testament Greek translation, it says angel. So you could say, you could literally interpret it, the gods that are surrounding the throne, I sing praise not to them. I mean, there are times where humans are awe-inspired by the angels, right? The messengers that come.
Yeah, they want to worship.
And what do they tell them? Don't
John
don't
at the end of Revelation. That's right.
Yeah, Daniel, he's like, hey, stand up.
Yeah.
You know, Daniel 10, stand up. No, stand up. You're not going to worship me. I'm just a watcher. I'm just an angel. So it's healthy to understand that, you know, and the reason why we won't just call them angels, because some people say, John, why don't you just call them angels? I said, well, because that's confusing, because it's like saying all humans are male. Man, you got a lot of explaining to do.
Yeah.
Like, how do you get babies if all humans are male, man? That doesn't work. So not all spirits that are outside of God are angels. And we'll do a whole nother episode on angels, but angels, literally a description of a job.
So yeah, like function.
You have humans who are mailmen.
You're exactly. A messenger.
Not all humans are mailmen. Not all humans are mailmen, but we have mailmen who are humans. So not all gods are angels, but all angels are gods.
Are Elohim.
Are Elohim. If they're in the, and so when you read these passages and it's in the positive light where he says he's the God of gods, which our King is the God of those who are in allegiance and obedience to him and those who are not, he's over all. We believe that. But in these particular passages, the psalmist is speaking in a positive light, like in the midst of this myriad of spiritual beings, there is one at the center, and there's one to whom we will. And this, Doug, I think, is a comparative to the nations. Like the nations worship the created beings. They get it all wrong. We, in the midst, we don't worship them. We worship you. And I think there's a comparative there. Like, God, we understand. Like, when you called us to have no other gods before you, in my worship, I will exalt that and say, I don't worship anything else other than you. And I think there is a comparative of like Israel versus the pagans, because in your worship, it's good to teach theology in that way. And I think that's exactly what's happening. Just a couple of more examples of where you have the word Elohim being used. I'll just throw these out here. Deuteronomy 32:17, the word Elohim is used of demons. It says, they sacrifice to demons who were not God Elohim, to gods Elohim, whom they have not known. We'll have to do a whole another episode on this next phrase. To new gods, that'll be fun, who came lately. Well, how do you have new gods coming lately? Well, that's a fascinating one. Not going to get into that today. Whom your fathers did not dread. So you have here, again, the word being used amongst demons and demons being worshipped, and they're in this category of Elohim. Any other thoughts about demons and Elohim?
Well, that, you know, demons is a whole huge subject.
We'll get to it.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
So I'll just.
And we've done stuff on the past, and you can go back and listen to that.
Yeah.
But this is kind of like what I would call, what I call it is the supernatural 101. We're going to just try.
Yeah.
And
let's stick with basics. Stick with the idea that angels, that Elohim describes creatures in the other realm. That's really what you're getting at there.
Yeah. And I'll throw this out to you.
You know, this one of the problems is that people think that demons are fallen angels, and that's actually incorrect, as we've said on multiple occasions. Demons and angels are different types of creatures.
So they're half fallen angels.
Exactly.
But, sorry.
Yeah, I mean it's a whole other subject. The point
we're not getting into it.
The point is that the heavenly realm is full of a whole bunch of different kinds of creatures.
That's
lots
right.
of them. It's a host of heaven, the heavenly host that they worship.
Yeah, and so you got seraphim, cherubim, you got angels, you got demons.
You got demons, you got humans that are exalted, that are called Elohim in the story of Samuel and Saul, who calls him up from the Witch of Endor.
That's an important story.
It is. It's a weird one to me that people, like, they don't actually just sit and read the text. Mm-mm. You know, Saul goes to the witch, who all the witches have been banished by him. Mm-hmm. And yet he manages to find one, which is funny. And then he says, hey, I want you to conjure up for me Samuel. And so she's like, I probably shouldn't do this, but okay. So she conjures up an Elohim is what it says. So something comes up from the other realm.
That's right. It
immediately identifies itself as Samuel. And Saul's like, well, you know, he says, what does he look like? And she describes him, and it's like, oh, that's Samuel. Then he starts talking as Samuel and gives him a prediction that he's gonna die as coming from the other side, you know, that, and then he does die. And for the life of me, it's like, again, it's this worldview that says, nope, the gods aren't real. And so people immediately read that and they go, well, that's not really Samuel. It's something imposing itself as Samuel. It's like, first of all, that's not what the text says. Second of all, you have no reason to, but why would a demon, which is an evil creature, pretend to be Samuel and give a true prophecy about the end of Saul's life?
Well, and I think that she was shocked.
She was
because
totally
I think,
shocked. She was not expecting to see what she saw.
She screamed and said, you fooled
exactly.
me. I think she was used to dealing with probably demons. And all of a sudden, she's like,
something else.
Oh,
Yeah.
Something else is here. I'm not used to this. And then she says, well, what are you seeing? And she's thinking, I'm not seeing a human. I'm seeing an Elohim. She uses this word.
And I think and that important. Elohim even uses the language of, why did you call me out of my sleep or something like that? You know, like
that's right.
That, and that's not something that a demon would say. That's something that when you read the rest of the Old Testament, and you find out what they believed about what happened to humans when they died. Like that was it. And so everything about that story says that Samuel was an Elohim. And the most interesting thing about that is that, first of all, you have a human being called Elohim. But second of all, he's the only human in the entire Old Testament that's called an Elohim. No other humans, no living son of Adam is ever called an Elohim.
An Elohim.
Ever.
And we'll get into this when we talk about the divine council, because that is very important to understand. Hey, I just want to have fun for a second. So like, I can totally see how you got Samuel is in paradise and he's like, oh, I am so done being a prophet. That was rough. That is a rough life, right? So he's in paradise. He's enjoying it. It's great. And all of a sudden he's like, what? You know, an angel comes on and goes, hey, man, it's hard, dude. We need you. He's like, for what? He's like, you got to go back and talk to Saul. What? No, I died already. I'm not going back there. If I'm going back there, that guy's going to get it. You know, you could just, because like you don't think about, like, Samuel's in this place, right? He's in Hades. We did a whole episode on that. And I could just see this angel coming up and be like, dude, I hate to tell you this, man. We need to go back for a little bit. All right. So a couple other things, not only demons and the dead, but the word is also used in like First Kings for gods and goddesses, female gods. So you have a whole list where it says, because they have forsaken me and worship Astaroth, the goddess Elohim. So it's not only describing God, male, but female gods. And there's a whole list of them that are here. Now, in the context, just to help you understand, it's using the word Elohim. It's not calling them idols. And it's giving them names. So these Elohim have known names among the prophet and prophesying about what's happening. And the reason why I'm bringing this towards the end is that when the prophets are calling out these Elohim by name, they are saying there are created spirit beings that are being worshiped at the same level as God, and that is forbidden. This is why, Doug, I'm like, after I've learned this, it makes the first commandment. So you ignore the first commandment, the rest of them are destroyed when you think about it. Because what do the gods do? They turn the heart of the people away
to violate all the rest of the commandments is what they turn their heart to do.
Which,
sacrifice your children in the fires to Molech. Okay, so now you've just caused me to break the sixth commandment, not to murder.
That's right. Sexual sins.
Sexual sins at the temples with their priests and their prostitutes.
That's right. The mutilation of their bodies. Mm-hmm. But wait a minute. Wait, are we talking about United States or Old Testament?
No, it couldn't be, because the gods aren't real and that doesn't actually happen. So we're just making these things up and it's just our own idols. You know, I was looking just kind of randomly at the word God, just going through. I just typed in a search engine and it happened upon Isaiah 21:9. Very interesting verse. Fallen is Babylon and all the carved images of her gods. Now that's interesting. Mm-hmm. So the gods are being made into the likenesses of what these entities are in the form of statues. But the gods are separate from the statues. The statues are images of the gods.
Her gods. That's
They're
right.
separate from each other.
That's right. So which means you have to have something to create the image of.
And to name. Right, exactly. And to further, as we could talk about with idols, to incant that entity through magic and ritual to come and live in that house, which is what essentially the idol became.
Yeah, and we'll do an episode on this where we'll walk you through some passages that give clear indications of like, how does idolatry work amongst the gods? We just want to introduce it to you here. But the reason why I'm mentioning this is that the first commandment, it's not, sometimes we think, and in Reformed theology, I'm very thankful for this, man, saint-centered reality, like, I was born depraved and my heart naturally wants to wander. And it's true. Like, Doug, I don't need anybody's help to be a horrendous person. I do a good job on my own. And yet we take that too far. And we'll say, yeah, you guys like to talk about all this stuff, but I don't need help. As if Satan sits on the sideline and goes, let me know if you need help testing you. He doesn't do that. He doesn't sit on the sidelines and say, well, look, I'll get in a fight with you if once you get your flesh under control. That's not how it works, right? We have three enemies, right? It's Satan, our flesh, and the world. And that's coming at us constantly. So I think what's fascinating is that God starts immediately with the source. Where do you get your information from? And if you put another God with me, that God will not agree with me, because any God, any Elohim, any spirit being that would cause worship towards them would never do that if they were loyal to me. They would never, ever do that. And if they are doing that, they're going to turn your heart away. I think a perfect example of this, the wisest man in the world, what happened to him?
Worshiping the gods because of the women.
His heart was turned by the women who said, you should worship our gods. He started worshiping our gods, and the whole nation became pagan. So this is why that command is so important. It's not the idols of your heart that are at risk here. It's not worrying about your flesh. The first commandment is there are other real powerful beings that will turn you away from me. Don't follow them.
It's interesting, do gods convey information? That's an interesting question.
Yes.
And the New Testament tells you that they do. Paul says 100%. At the beginning of Galatians, if even an angel from heaven should come and give another gospel than the one we are giving you, let him be eternally condemned. And he doesn't just say it once. He's so mad about this that he says it twice, mm-hmm. right in a row. That's kind of the thesis statement of Galatians. An angel from heaven delivering messages. That mm-hmm. is a different message. Now, of course, they convey information because that's the point of an angel. But we've already said that angels are the gods of the Old Testament. And where this really becomes fascinating is when you understand that Paul is writing this to the Galatians. Mm-hmm. And what happened when he was up in Galatia on his first missionary journey? He entered one of the towns, and they started worshiping him as Hermes. Started worshiping Barnabas as Zeus.
As Zeus.
And they don't say, don't do that. Those beings don't exist. What they say is, don't do that, but turn from these vain, worthless, false things. Not false in the sense of non-existence, but false in the sense of they're liars.
That's right.
And turn to the real God. And that is the connection there between Acts 13, I think it is, and Galatians 1 that lets you know Paul isn't just saying this because he has nothing better to say, because it's some crazy hyperbole. He's saying it because these people literally worshiped him as a god.
That's right. So to that point, sometimes people really have a struggle with this. And so for me, the hammer that just kind of finishes the nail down, it's like coffin gone, is Paul. If you're saying to believe that more than one Elohim exists in reality is polytheism, Paul straight up says in 2 Corinthians 4:4, in their case, the God of this world, talking about Satan, has blinded the minds of the unbeliever. By the way, God there is theos. It's the same word used for our God and King, the Jesus, our Lord and Savior, God, same word, theos. He is saying there is a theos that is blinding the world. Now, Doug, I don't know about you, but it says it's keeping them from seeing the light of the gospel. I don't think the idols can do that. That's an active work that's happening here. And he's saying that this is what's happening, and it is a God. And so it's at least, if you're going to say that to believe that another God exists is polytheism, then by nature, Paul's a polytheist.
You know what's funny about that? First of all, is that polytheism is a modern word, just like mm-hmm. monotheism, just like henotheism, just like monarchism. All these words that we have come up with to try and understand and label what ancient religions were, They're only like 200 or 300 years old. So right. The most ironic thing about that to me is we're like, that's polytheism. Well, guess what? The Romans called Christians atheists.
Atheists.
Why? Because they only believed in one God.
One God. They rejected the gods.
It's just so funny to me that the Romans used terms in order to attack Christians that were ridiculous. I'm not an atheist. Right. I believe in God. Just like we use terms to attack theology that we don't like, even though, like, you couldn't get a word that's more abundant in the Old Testament than the word Elohim. It appears over 2,300 times in the Old Testament.
It's a lot.
And many, many, many of those times, it's not talking about God. It's talking about these other entities. So we just have to come to grips with the reality of what the text says and then try and start thinking through it the best that we can. And we believe that there's absolutely nothing that is contradictory with Reformed theology and this worldview. In fact, I just was thinking about this, John, with regard to our confession of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to just do a word search, and I used the original language. I didn't use one of the modern revisions of the 1689. and I looked up first the word gods. You know how many times the word gods appears in the confession of faith?
I read the article, so I'm not going to answer.
Yeah, the answer is zero. Our confession of faith says nothing about gods. Nothing. Yeah. That leaves it kind of open for us to start thinking about it on our own. Then I decided, well, how about angels? How many times does it appear? Well, and the answer is like 6 or 7. Okay, mm-hmm. So what does it tell us about these angels? Well, essentially, chapter 2.2 tells us that angels, like men, owe God alone all worship and obedience, which is kind of what we've been saying about Psalms when it calls them Elohim.
Right.
It tells us in 3.3 that angels are predestined to eternal life, just like some humans are. Some angels, some humans. That's all it says. Then the next paragraph says that the number of the elect angels cannot be increased or decreased. That's all it says. That's telling you that there's some angels that are fallen and some that aren't, or at least elect. Some that are saved and some that aren't, some that are elect and some that aren't elect.
That's right.
What would you call a fallen, non-elect angel? Gee, I don't know. How about a god like Zeus, like, or I mean, better, technically, like Satan, the god
well,
of
yeah,
this
that's,
world.
That's exactly where I was going. That you have an angel who served the king, who rebelled, and Paul calls him a god. So it is very, very theologically accurate to say that those who are in rebellion and those who are in allegiance can have the title Elohim. Now, Doug, I'm going to read one last verse. Was that it for the...
Well, I was thinking of one more. Yeah. Some of these overlap, but in chapter 8.4 and then also later in 32.1, it basically says that angels will be judged for their good and evil actions at the end of time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here we have the judgment of God upon the angels, just like this on humans. And gee, I wonder where you would go to prove something like that. I don't know. Revelation throwing Satan into the lake of fire.
First Peter, change.
And all kinds of places that you can go to that. And the point is that everything that our confession tells us about what angels are is exactly what we're saying the gods are, because they're identical.
That's right. And a lot of times they go to the point where it says the Lord our God is one. And we would agree. The Lord our God, the God of the Christian faith, the God of Israel, the Lord our God is one. He is unique. And so to say that the other gods exist does not go against the confession, which I think is interesting, because sometimes people quote that. I've had it quoted to me. I'm like, are you paying attention to the language of the writers there? They're making a distinction between the other gods. Our God is one, and we would embrace that. But that doesn't mean that particular section of the confession does not mean that it's saying that there is that the other gods do not exist.
It's like, it would be like saying that Jesus was a human and Jesus is God, therefore no other humans exist.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Or that Jesus wasn't a God, which people do make that mistake.
Or that because Jesus, he was human. I mean, that's your only other option.
Right, which is what First John is dealing with. They were like, he's not God.
Exactly.
And it's like, all right, if anybody says that, then they're not a Christian. Because there's no way, because that's what, we'll get into this, but even thinking about, we'll get into the Psalm 82, but when Jesus literally says, he quotes Psalm 82, and he's basically saying, I am a God. And that should shock you. It should, like, why can I make all these claims? Because I am God. I am the Son of God. We'll get into that. Doug, there's a whole nother passage that I want to end here that what I think is interesting, Paul says there's a spiritual realm and you're at war with it, and never once mentions an angel or a demon. I never thought about this till now. He says he never mentions angels and demons. Watch, listen to this. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against authorities, against cosmic powers over this present darkness, over against the spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places. The point is, the Elohim realm, the spiritual realm, has a lot of players, a lot of people doing, a lot of beings doing a lot of things. And I think Paul's drawing on the Old Testament, which we're going to get into, things like Daniel and the Watchers and Deuteronomy, where he's got the gods of the nations being dispersed over them. He is describing the spiritual realm. And the reason why Doug and I are kind of throwing our hands up saying, if you reject the gods of the Old Testament, how in the world are you going to take that to be legitimate? You don't. And people ignore it. And we don't put on the full armor of God, which is Christ in the gospel. We don't preach the gospel. We don't think we're at war. So what do? We do moralism and legalism, because those are fleshly means. And Paul's like, can't fight this war in the flesh. Won't work. You have to think in spiritual. You have to think in faith.
You know, you brought up that the language there of Ephesians. And one thing we didn't really do was define what gods are, other than to say that they're entities in the spiritual realm. But I think you can say one more thing about them, mm-hmm. is that all gods have some sort of ruling capacity to them. Mm. You just think about the gods of the nations, and that's literally what they're doing. From a divine council, right. They administer the affairs of the cosmos. They are mm-hmm. ruling over the nations. That's the purpose of what they're supposed to do. That's their existence. All of them have that. And that's so funny, because those titles that Paul gives, every one of them has to do with ruling and authority. All of them.
Whoa.
In fact, they're called rulers and authorities.
Principalities.
And principalities. Like that's what they do. And even when you think about
forces.
when you think about a believers on the other side as being Elohim, not in a Mormon sense. Mm-hmm. That's a totally corrupted view of what humans are, and their corruption.
Like they corrupt Jesus, they corrupt this too.
Their corruption stems from their doctrine of God, mm-hmm. because as God once was, so we will be.
Yeah, that is not what we are saying.
Not at all. And you think about whenever humans are associated with things like stars or ruling in the other side, it's because we become sons of God and we rule. Mm-hmm. Somehow for eternity in that spiritual new realm. We're not called that kind of a thing today, because today we're called to suffer the kingdom, mm-hmm. to spread the gospel, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. But we inherit mm-hmm. this title as sons of God, and one day we will rule like the gods. We will, in fact, judge angels. Do you not know that? Paul says.
That's right.
Because that's one of the marks of what happens when you're on the other side and you become Elohim.
That's right. Oh man, that'll freak people out. So
that'll totally freak people out. But we already talked about it, John.
We become
all
God's,
we're
I know
doing
Samuel
is connecting the dots, because we already said Samuel was called an Elohim. What does that mean? It means that he's a spiritual, supernatural entity that somehow had some sort of a capacity to rule or judge. And that's exactly what he did. He came back and he told Samuel, or Saul, you're going to die because of what you've done. He pronounced a judgment, which is what they do. That's what the Watchers are doing in Daniel chapter 4. This is not a deification in that kind of a way that people think of. We stay human. We stay fully human, just like Jesus.
That's right.
He's still a human, glorified, exalted, now ruling at the right hand of the Father. And that is what the promise of the new covenant, one of the promises, the ultimate promise, that we will rule by his side for eternity. That's right. How in the world could that be objectionable? Only reason why is because you attach the word gods to it. And the reason why that's objectionable is because we have a perverted view of what God even means in the Bible.
Yeah, and that's kind of what we're getting at.
That's the whole point of this show, this episode.
That's right. We wanted to give you a fuller biblical perspective of the word Elohim, of the word God, so that as you read it, you know what kind of God you're talking about. Is it the God Yahweh? Are we talking about a demon, a devil, an angel? You know, what are we talking about? And to take it serious, because I think that Doug, I don't remember the man's name, but it was a French scientist who in the late 1800s discovered as he was watching in this hospital that the women who were giving birth in the maternity ward, their child had a higher rate of success of living than those who were giving birth in the hospital. Have you heard this? And so, he started to do this, and he was trying to figure out what was happening. But what was happening is that the men who were giving birth in the hospital were messing with cadavers and learning and going straight from that to giving birth without washing their hands. And the men in the maternity ward were only giving birth, and so they weren't going from dead, diseased, germified bodies. And so he said, hey, I want you to start washing your hands before birth. And, you know, just in a short while, the birth rate went extremely up. So he went to the whole hospital and says, I want everybody to start washing our hands because we have this thing called germs and they're actually causing people to die. And they are like, there's no way us washing our hands, not washing our hands is what's causing death. We will not embrace that to be a fact, because then you're saying it's our fault they're dying. He was 35 years old. It drove him nuts. He ended up going insane and dying in an insane asylum. And it was 30 years later when finally someone else had like concluded reading his work and like, we should probably do this.
Yep. Yep.
And I think some of this is that where, Doug, people are a little afraid to go, yeah, I don't think I want to embrace this. This seems dangerous. This seems off. Like, you know, Christianity hasn't ever believed this. You guys are starting something new. Well, we're going to show you in upcoming episodes that what Doug and I are teaching you has been the perspective of the church for hundreds of years. This is not new to the church.
Thousands of years.
Yeah, thousands of years. That's absolutely right. And so we'll demonstrate that to you, that first of all, I don't ever like going to history first. I like going to the text first and say, hey, it's pretty clear in the text, but we're not the first to see it either. That's always very confirming, which is why Doug and I love confessions. And we love church history. So the last reason I want to point this out, and it really goes back to the first commandment. I think we're being influenced heavily by these gods of the nations, and we don't realize it. And we're seeing their work in our homes and our media and our country. And once you start paying attention to it, you can see how they're turning their hearts towards violence, towards all kinds of immorality.
There's a point here, John, that I think is fascinating. When you look at the names for the gods of the Greeks are, you find that they're actually the vices of ethics. So you have a god of lust, Eros. Mm-hmm. So what we'll say is we desupernaturalize it and we go, oh, you're turning women, you're lusting after women, and that's become your god. Well, guess what? That was literally a god of the Greeks.
That's right.
Like literally.
Which we get erotic from, am I right?
Exactly. And so what that means is that we can actually be kidding ourselves and saying that we're not violating the first commandment in the sense that we think that we are, while we say that we're violating it in another way. So don't have the god of lust in your life. But the reality is that there's a supernatural reality that's behind that.
That's right.
That some kind of an entity is a part of. How does that work? I don't know how that works. But the point is, it's maybe much more directly related to what the text says of having other gods than we want to realize in our materialistic, naturalized, anti-supernatural, modern Christian worlview.
Yeah. I mean, Doug, if I were to walk over and I say, hey, I want you to have this song, and it's a beautiful song, and it's got some weird stuff in it, but it's a really beautiful song. And you're listening to it, you're like, yeah, man, this is pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Who wrote this song? Where is it from? And I say, well, it's from Adolf Hitler. Immediately the source, you're just like, yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know if I will like constantly be listening to a song from a guy like that. Right.
Dude, you know where you know where the ancient people believed that songs originated?
No.
In the Muse. And the Muse was a supernatural entity that would come and fill up the vessel and cause them to go in an ecstatic state, and they would just start writing.
No.
And that's really? What music, that's what me think about the etymology of music. It comes from the word muse. Go look up the muse. It's the exact same thing. So you're making music your God. Well, you don't understand that music is already attached to them.
To a God. Yeah.
And it's also attached to the Lord God, because the muse was supposed to, the way all of them were supposed to, lead people into good and benevolent and wonderful things. Yes. But instead, they end up taking the worship for themselves. And then you end up worshiping the stars of the people who make the music. And I mean, the whole thing, it just becomes a perversion. The problem is the perversion. The problem is not what is actually happening in the way God designed it to be.
And it's always a perversion, right? They themselves are a perversion. So they were a good created being that was designed to be honoring and beneficial, and they corrupted, and they take the rest of creation and corrupt it. I think sometimes, Doug, when you realize where things come from, and the source of them, and their real entities trying to draw us towards those things, that when what we're wrestling is this whole army that's trying to corrupt our morals, corrupt our mind, intoxicate us. This is why Peter says, do not be intoxicated with the world, right? Be sober minded. So the whole point of the start of this first episode is we just want you to look at your Bible and go, okay, I think these things are real. Paul believed they were real. Peter believed they're real. John believed they were real. Obviously, Jesus does, because straight up talks about them being real. I think what's interesting is that even Jesus says that Matthew 24, he says that the false prophets will even be able to perform signs and wonders to deceive even the elect. Like they can, we'll talk about a whole episode of magic, but there are times that they can actually do things that are supernatural. These beings that are, we call idols, they can't. So, this has been a long episode. We're already an hour in. So for those of you that like long episodes, I'm sure you're super thankful. For those of you that are like, you guys talked way, I know. For those of you that are like, you guys talked way too long, we're sorry. You can listen it in half. Stop halfway through, and then next week, listen to the rest of it. Hey, we're super thankful. This episode one, we'll pick back up where we left off this week, where we'll continue thinking about the gods, and we'll go into idols. How do the two match? And our goal ultimately is always to talk about Jesus and how this is applied to our everyday life. Hopefully you've seen that all throughout the episode. Thank you for listening. Hey, if you have questions and you're like, I have so many questions, I have so many things I need to ask you guys, the Reform Fringe, reformfringe.com. Come check it out. We'd love to see you in there. And we are planning on scheduling some Q&A's. So that's a good way to hop onto a live Q&A with Doug and I. Thank you guys. Or at least Doug. I'm not committing to anything yet. At least Doug. We'll talk to you guys soon. See ya.